Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in Daniel chapter 10, which I will call Introduction to Daniel's Last Revelation. A little bit of introduction here from Albert Barnes. This was the last revelation made to Daniel. When I say this, I mean chapters 10, 11, and 12. Chapter 10 is an introduction to the revelations of the last two chapters of the book, as Barnes says. And the time frame extends all the way from the time that Daniel was prophesying to the time of the Messiah, as Barnes says. Not necessarily to the end of the world, although we will look at that possibility and the conflicts concerning those views as we go through these last three chapters. We begin now in Daniel 10, verse 1. In the third year of Cyrus, king of Persia, a message was revealed to Daniel, who was named Belteshazzar. The message was true and was about a great conflict. He understood the message and had understanding of the vision. Now, this vision was given to Daniel in the third year of Cyrus. That would be the third year after Cyrus had seized Babylon, which by all accounts was in 539 B.C., as Poole points out. Daniel had been working in Babylon, of course, until Cyrus the Great of Persia conquered Babylon in 539. We know that from Daniel 1, verse 21. Daniel remained there until the first year of King Cyrus. So Daniel was still working in Babylon about this time. 3 years from 539 would put us somewhere around 537 or so. Daniel, it is stated here in verse 1, was named Belteshazzar. That was Daniel's Babylonian name. It means Bel will protect. Now the message was true, of course, and it was about a great conflict. The great conflict is about the conflict between the world empires. Alexander the Great is going to beat the Persians, and then Alexander's going to die, and then the successor kingdoms, the Diadochi, are going to fight with each other, especially in chapter 11, the kings of the north. That's the Seleucid Empire and the kings of the south. That's the Ptolemaic empires. All of that's going to be described in the next couple of chapters. We're going to go all the way down to the time of Herod the Great, who died in 4 BC when Jesus was born. So you can see that all these great conflicts are going to take place. It's going to take us up to the time of the Messiah. We go to now to Daniel 10, verse 2. In those days, I, Daniel, was mourning for 3 full weeks. Now, why was he mourning? It could be that so few Jews had returned with Ezra from the exile. Remember, this is just about the time of the return. 3 years after Cyrus conquered Babylon. He conquered Babylon in 539 and, according to Wikipedia, gave the great edict, his edict, for the Jews to return and build the temple in 539. And so the return was probably the next year, maybe 538 or so. But it was a small band that left Babylon. Perhaps Daniel was mourning because the Jews had faced severe opposition in building the temple in Jerusalem. The great preacher Charles Spurgeon believed that Daniel was mourning because he was thinking about the great conflict that was mentioned in verse 1. However, it seems to me that the mourning that Daniel was doing was before he had the vision. Seems to me he was mourning and praying, and then he had the vision and was told about the great conflict. It could be he was thinking about the 70 weeks, which involved the cutting off of the Messiah and the destruction of Jerusalem, which is not a pleasant thought for a Jewish person. But actually, we don't know why he was mourning, but he was. Now, notice it doesn't say he was fasting. It says he was mourning. We go now to verse 3, Daniel 10. I didn't eat any rich food. No meat or wine entered my mouth, and I didn't put any oil on my body until the 3 weeks were over. Now, it says he didn't eat, but that doesn't mean it was a fast. He ate some food. He says he didn't eat any rich food. He didn't eat any meat. He probably ate vegetables only. He was used to doing that sort of thing back when he was working for Nebuchadnezzar, you recall. But it wasn't a fast. As Guzik, the commentator, says, the biblical idea of fasting is to abstain from food altogether. I like that comment from Guzik because I hear so many people saying, well, I'm going to live a fasted life. I didn't drive over the speed limit this week. I live a fasted life. I didn't eat any cake and ice cream this week. I ate plenty of shrimp and steak, but not cake and ice cream. Or maybe I ate half of what I normally eat. My portions were small. That's not a fast. A fast is when you don't eat, as Guzik says. So Daniel wasn't fasting, but he probably didn't feel like eating because he was so upset. He He was mourning over the fate of his people. He was mourning over the fate of the Jews. In verse 3, Daniel says, I didn't put any oil on my body. The Jews would do that at feast, maybe anoint their heads with oil, let the oil run down, rub the oil on their face, make their face shine. But they wouldn't do that when they were fasting and humbling themselves. But at any rate, oil is a symbol of gladness, and Daniel wasn't glad, so he didn't put any oil on his body for 3 weeks. We go now to Daniel 10, verse 4. On the 24th day of the first month, as I was standing on the bank of the great river, the Tigris, well, the 24th day of what month? It could be the first month of the third year of Cyrus, because this is the third year since Cyrus conquered Babylon, or it could be the first month of the Jewish year, which is Nisan. So this could be Nisan 24th. We don't know. It doesn't matter. The dates are not all that important, fortunately, in this chapter. Daniel is standing on the bank of the great river, the Tigris. The Tigris is the westernmost of the two rivers cradling the cradle of civilization, the Mesopotamian Valley. Now, Babylon is on the Euphrates, and Daniel somehow ends up on the Tigris. As Barnes says, Daniel was apparently employed at some times in other parts of the Persian Empire besides Babylon. Barnes also says that prophets often resorted to banks of rivers because they were out-of-the-way places favorable to devotion. So at any rate, he's on the Tigris River. We go to verse 5. This is Daniel speaking, I looked up, and there was a man dressed in linen with a belt of gold from Uphaz around his waist. Now, I'm going to call this man dressed in linen with a belt of gold. People disagree over who he is, but we know he was a man dressed in linen with a belt of gold, and I'm going to shorten that even more to a man with a golden belt. Now, we learn later that this man was an angel, but angels on earth often take the appearance of a man, and that's why he's called a man in verse 5. There was a man dressed in linen. Now, who was this man? I'm going to give you three options: Jesus, Gabriel, or Michael. I do not believe it was Jesus, but here are the options for those commentators who say it was Jesus. They point out that the description of this man is remarkable for its likeness to the description of Jesus in Revelation chapter 1, verses 12 through 16. I'll read that now. I turned to see whose voice it was that spoke to me. When I turned, I saw seven gold lampstands, and among the lampstands was one like the Son of Man, dressed in a long robe and with a gold sash wrapped around his chest. So, in Revelation, it was Jesus, one like the Son of Man, so you know that's Jesus. He had a gold sash around his chest, and this man that appeared to Daniel had a gold belt around his waist. Well, that's not an awful lot to identify the two. One of my commentators said that Jesus often appeared before his incarnation as a pledge of his incarnation. In other words, there were epiphanies in the Old Testament before Jesus actually showed up in the flesh, and I believe that. But I don't think this particular epiphany to Daniel was Jesus. And the reason I say that is because of Daniel 10:13, which says this, But the prince of the kingdom of Persia opposed me for 21 days. Then Michael, and this is Gabriel speaking, then Michael, one of the chief princes, came to help me. I should say this is the man with the belt of gold speaking, who I think is Gabriel, but it doesn't really say. But whoever it was, Michael came to help me. Well, if the man with the golden belt is Jesus, why would he need Michael to help him? I don't think the Son of God needs anybody to help him do anything. Well, you could argue that angels are ministers of flaming fire sent out to minister to God's people, to do God's will. You could say that. So that's not a slam dunk argument, but still, it makes you think Jesus is getting help. I don't think so. Those who say it is Jesus, they say this man was dressed in linen like a priest, and Jesus was a priest, and the gold belt that he was wearing represents this, and the gold belt that he was wearing represents Jesus as a king, because gold represents royalty. Well, I think that's a stretch. I'm going to give you two other reasons when I get to verse 11 to advocate for Gabriel as opposed to Jesus as being the man in the white linen with the golden belt. The second option as to who this man in white linen with the golden belt is Gabriel, as I said. We know from Daniel 8:16 that Gabriel had given a previous vision, or at least explained a previous vision to Daniel, Daniel 8:16, and I heard a man's voice between the banks of Ulai, which called and said, Gabriel, make this man to understand the vision. This is the little horn vision, the Daniel 8 little horn. The banks of the Ulai were a river that flowed into the Tigris River, to the east of the Tigris in Elam. And that angel was Gabriel, and so it makes sense to think, well, Gabriel showed up once, he showed up again in chapter 10. But anyway, I'll save my arguments for verse 11 by trying to show you that this man is Gabriel. I'm just going to call him Gabriel from now on. Now, Gabriel was wearing a belt of gold from Uphaz. Nobody knows exactly where Uphaz is. Most identify it with Ophir. And, of course, nobody knows where Ophir is. But most scholars say that Ophir is in southwest Arabia, which is current Yemen. If you look at the Saudi Arabian Peninsula and look at the extreme southwestern tip right over against the Red Sea and also the Indian Ocean, that's Yemen. That's where Sheba was said to be. It's famous for gold. We go now to Daniel 10, verse 6. His body, that's referring to the man in white linen with the gold belt, Gabriel. His body was like topaz, his face like the brilliance of lightning, his eyes like flaming torches, his arms and feet like the gleam of polished bronze, and the sound of his words like the sound of a multitude. Now, topaz is some kind of a rock, and I've learned when it comes to rocks in the Old Testament, nobody knows what rock is what. Here's some options I found amongst the commentators. His body was azure, like the sky, blue. It was green like the sea, emerald green. No, his body is like sardonyx, which is flesh-colored. No, his body was really chrysolite, which is golden. Who knows? It was just shining. His face was like the brilliance of lightning, majestic, awesome, even as Christ is the Son of Righteousness, the S-U-N of righteousness. But I don't think this is Jesus here. I think it's Gabriel. His eyes like flaming torches. They're penetrating like Jesus' eyes were penetrating in Revelation, somewhere around that previous verse I read for you in chapter 1, I believe it was. Jesus had eyes flaming like fire, but again, I don't think this is Jesus. I think it's Gabriel. His arms and feet like the gleam of polished bronze. Of course, bronze is firm and steady, and if you've got feet that are bronze, you can stomp on your enemies with no fear of your feet breaking. But his arms also were like polished bronze, not just his feet. And the sound of his words like the sound of a multitude. When he talked, his words were awesome. They were majestic, just like Jesus in Revelation. That's why people think that this might be Jesus here, because the picture of Gabriel is so awesome. I could be wrong, of course, but I don't think I am. I think this is Gabriel, not Jesus. We go now to Daniel 10, verse 7. Only I, Daniel, saw the vision. The men who were with me did not see it. But a great terror fell on them, and they ran and hid. Now, who were the men with Daniel? They were probably Daniel's pagan Persian fellow government officials. As pagans, they naturally would be terror-stricken. Now, they didn't actually see the vision, but they knew something was going on. They must have sensed the man with the golden sash without actually seeing him. They ran and hid. I can't help but speculate exactly what they did see. How much of that? They didn't see Gabriel, but they knew something was going on. Interesting. We go to verse 8, Daniel 10. I was left alone. That's because his compadres had fled and hid. Daniel was left alone looking at this great vision. No strength was left in me. My face grew deathly pale, and I was powerless. No strength was left in Daniel. As a commentator named Wood says, this suggests a death-like paleness combined with a grotesque wrenching of facial features. Ooh, that's pretty nasty. So this vision was not a pleasant experience. Scared Daniel half to death. His face grew deathly pale. Now, this is how John Gill, in his inimitable fashion, recast that description of deathly pale. The form of his countenance was marred, his forehead wrinkled, his eyes sunk, the sprightliness and vivacity of them gone, his cheeks turned pale, his lips quivering, his joints trembling, his vigor and health impaired, all nature convulsed, and he lifeless and spiritless like a dead carcass. Well, I don't think you can explain Daniel's physical appearance any better than that. We go now to Daniel 10, verse 9. Daniel says, I heard the words he said, and when I heard them, I fell into a deep sleep with my face to the ground. Why did Daniel, upon seeing Gabriel and hearing him speak, why did Daniel fall with his face to the ground? Here's a couple of options. Worship, praise, adoration, and prayer. I don't know. Second option, he was exhausted and just fell. Third option, he was lulled into sleep by the sweetness of Gabriel's voice. I don't think that's the correct option. And I don't think it's worship, praise, adoration, and prayer because he says, I fell into a deep sleep. You don't worship, praise, adore, and pray when you're sleeping. So I think he was just frightened and exhausted from fear and terror. We go now to verse 10 of Daniel 10. Suddenly a hand touched me and raised me to my hands and knees. Now that hand probably belonged to Gabriel, probably belonged to the man with the belt of gold, whom I took to be Gabriel. Can't say for sure. Some have speculated that it was an attendant of the man with the belt of gold. An attendant. Well, let's just keep it simple. We'll say it's Gabriel. Gabriel touched Daniel and raised him to his hands and knees. We go to verse 11 of Daniel 10. He said to me, that's Gabriel, Daniel, you are a man treasured by God. Understand the words that I'm saying to you. Stand on your feet, for I have now been sent to you. After he said this to me, I stood trembling. Now, Gabriel tells Daniel here that Daniel is a man that's treasured by God. That's the same attribute that Gabriel attributed to Daniel in chapter 9, verses 22 and 23. And because we know that it was Gabriel calling Daniel a treasure in chapter 9, and we see this man with a golden sash calling Daniel treasured here in chapter 10, verse 11, it makes sense to think it's the same angel using the same terminology. In Daniel 9, 21 through 23, we read, While I was praying, Gabriel, the man I had seen in the first vision, came to me in my extreme weariness about the time of the evening offering. He gave me this explanation, Daniel, I've come now to give you understanding. At the beginning of your petition, an answer went out, and I have come to give it, for you are treasured by God. There's that same phrase, treasured by God. So, this man needed help from Michael, which makes me think it's not Jesus. He's using the same description of Daniel, which makes me think he is Gabriel. Gabriel tells Daniel to stand on your feet. Standing is a fitter position to receive a message from God, a fitter position than lying flat on your face. Now, Gabriel says, stand on your feet, for I have now been sent to you. This is another argument that this man with the golden belt is Gabriel. Angels are sent ones. They're ones that are sent to do the work of God. Jesus is not likely to have been sent. You could say that the Father sends the Son. I'm not going to get into a great Trinitarian debate over that. I guess you could say that, but it's more likely to be an angel, I think. So there's my three arguments for Gabriel. He was sent, he needed help, and he used the same description of Daniel in chapters 9 and chapter 10. We go now to Daniel 10, verse 12. Don't be afraid, Daniel, he said to me, for from the first day that you purposed to understand and to humble yourself before your God, your prayers were heard. I have come because of your prayers. Now the first day would be the first day of his three-week mourning period. That was the first day that Daniel had purposed to understand. That's why he was praying so hard. The first day that Daniel had purposed to humble himself before your God by getting on his face and not eating rich foods and partying and rejoicing, but just praying from the very first day. Now that tells us you pray for 21 days, you don't get an answer, and so what you going to think? God's not hearing my prayers. He doesn't care why I'm praying. He doesn't care about what I'm praying. So I'm just going to give up. Daniel didn't give up. He persevered. 21 days went by, and he gets an archangel to show up to give him the answers that he wanted. Great application here is persistent prayer. Don't expect God to answer right at your beck and call. Sometimes you need to persist. At any rate, Gabriel says he came because of those prayers of Daniel. And he tells Daniel from the first day that you purpose to understand. Understand what? Previous visions in Daniel's book? Nope, Daniel already understood those. That would be the four metal statue in chapter 2, the chopped down tree, which referred to Nebuchadnezzar in chapter 4. the four beasts, the lion, the bear, the ram, and the monster in chapter 7. In chapter 8, the ram and the goat with a little horn. That's Persia against Alexander the Great. The 70 years of captivity in chapter 9. I really should say the 70 years of Babylonian dominance. It never actually says the 7 years of captivity, but it says that Babylon will rule for 70 years. And then the 70 weeks, of course, the famous last four verses of chapter 9, which get us all the way to the cutting off of the Messiah in AD 30. Daniel understood all that. I assume he did, although you can make an argument he didn't understand. But it makes more sense to me that Daniel is trying to find out what's going to happen in the future about Israel. They're in exile. They're trying to get reestablished in the Promised Land. Things are not going well. And so I think that's what he was trying to understand. Gabriel's going to come explain it to him. Daniel 10, verse 13. Now it's Gabriel who is speaking. But the prince of the kingdom of Persia opposed to me for 21 days. Then Michael, one of the chief princes, came to help me after I had been left there with the kings of Persia. Now, notice the 21 days covers a span of time that exactly matches Daniel's period of mourning. Remember in Daniel 10, verses 2 through 3, in those days I, Daniel, was mourning for 3 full weeks. I didn't put any oil on my body until the 3 weeks were over. 3 times 7 is 21 days. So while Daniel is praying and mourning, Michael is whipping up on a demon in Persia, the prince of the kingdom of Persia. Now, I'm assuming that's a demon. Let's look at some options that have been suggested. Cyrus the Great, who ruled from 559 to 530, or maybe his son, Cambyses II, who ruled from 530 to 522. Well, either one of those would be a prince of the kingdom of Persia, but how are they going to be fighting Gabriel? No human being could have held up an archangel, so we'll ditch that option. Another suggestion, it's a good angel. The prince of the kingdom of Persia was a good angel that opposed Gabriel. No, good angels don't fight each other. So what does that leave? Satan, or at least one of Satan's top dogs, top demons. What would that demon be trying to do? Trying to rile up the leaders of Persia against God's people. And Gabriel, of course, was trying to positively influence the rulers of Persia so that the Persians would favor the Jews. And so there was a spiritual battle going on in heaven on behalf of the Jews in the case of Gabriel and against the Jews in the case of the prince of the kingdom of Persia, the demon in charge. Now, there are some other scriptural examples of angels fighting the devil. We read in Zechariah 3, verses 1 through 3, "Then he showed me Joshua the high priest standing before the angel of the Lord, and Satan standing at his right hand to accuse him." Now, that angel might be Jesus, usually is when it says angel of the Lord. But at any rate, you got the angel of the Lord, Satan next to him. Then the Lord says to Satan, "The Lord rebuke you, Satan. Indeed, the Lord who has chosen Jerusalem rebuke you." So there's a heavenly battle going on, let's put it that way, between the forces of God and the forces of Satan. Jude 1:9, "But Michael the archangel, when he disputed with the devil and argued about the body of Moses, did not dare pronounce against him a railing judgment, but said, 'The Lord rebuke you.'" We talked about that when I did my podcast on June. That probably came from the Apocrypha somewhere. And there's a question of whether that battle actually went on, or whether that was just a quote from Jewish folklore. But if it did go on, we have an example of an archangel fighting the devil. And then, of course, in Revelation 12, 7 through 8, "And there was war in heaven, Michael and his angels waging war with the dragon. The dragon and his angels waged war, and they were not strong enough, and there was no longer a place found for them in heaven." So, spiritual warfare between demons and angels is an idea I don't think that we want to dismiss. And I noticed that almost all of my commentators say that we have a battle here between Gabriel and demons. I don't think there's any dispute on that, hardly. Not only Gabriel, but Michael also, one of the chief priests he came to help. So Gabriel and Michael are fighting. Well, they were fighting for the 21 days, and then Gabriel took some time off and went to go talk to Daniel, but then we'll see he's going to go back to the fight later on. I assume Michael kept on fighting. Now, we might ask, how did the prince of the kingdom of Persia, this big demon, how did this demon oppose Gabriel for 21 days? John Gill speculates that this demon was stirring up Persians against the Jews. More particularly, many have thought that Cambyses II, the son of Cyrus, was stirred up against the Jews when Cyrus was out of town on a mission or on a battle. All that speculation, we don't know how the big demon who was prince of the kingdom of Persia opposed Gabriel. Then Michael, one of the chief princes, came to help Gabriel after the 21-day period was over. And as I said, it doesn't sound to me like that would be Jesus. It would not be Jesus who's speaking this, because why would Jesus need help? Came to help me after I'd been left there with the kings of Persia. So Gabriel, after the 21 days, was with the kings of Persia. Who are the kings of Persia? Now, Ellicott says that the kings were all the successors of Cyrus. The kings of Persia were all the successors of Cyrus the Great. As Ellicott says, from Cyrus onward, the Persian kings were, on the whole, favorable to Israel. As he says, by the subjugation of the demon of the Persian kingdom, his influence, not merely over Cyrus, but over all the following kings of Persia, was brought to an end, so that the whole of the Persian kings became accessible to the influence of the Spirit proceeding from God and advancing the welfare of Israel. Well, that's the best speculation that I've seen. We go now to Daniel 10, verse 14. Now I, and I'm assuming this is Gabriel speaking to Daniel, now I have come to help you understand what will happen to your people in the last days, for the vision refers to those days. Ah, there's that phrase in eschatology, last days. What does it mean here? Well, here I think it's pretty clear. It means the last days of Israel when the Messiah comes. As John Gill says, the last days generally design the days of the Messiah. Option number two, these are the last days of Israel after the events of the next chapter, chapter 11. In that chapter, as we will see, we have the Seleucids fighting the Ptolemies. We have the chapter finished up with Herod the Great, and that's getting close to the end of Israel's history. As Ellicott says, this is when the vision of Daniel 11 shall receive its complete fulfillment. Well, actually, option one is really the last days of Israel when the Messiah comes, which is the same thing as the last days of Israel after the events of chapter 11, because the events of chapter 11 are near the last days of Israel as a theological entity before it was destroyed in AD 70. Well, that's option number one, the last days of Israel when the Messiah comes. Option number two, the last days refers to future times extending down to the last period of the world. Barnes takes that futurist option, but the pulpit commentator disagrees with Barnes and says, quote, there seems no need to take the end of days as the end of the world. Well, I certainly see no need to do that, and so we won't. We go now to Daniel 10, verses 15 through 18. While he, that's Gabriel, was saying these words to me, Daniel, I turned my face toward the ground and was speechless. Suddenly one with human likeness touched my lips. I opened my mouth and said to the one standing in front of me, my Lord, because of the vision, anguish overwhelms me, and I am powerless. How can someone like me, your servant, speak with someone like you, my Lord? Now I have no strength, and there is no breath in me. Then the one with human likeness touched me again and strengthened me. So Daniel in verse 15 has his face turned toward the ground again. Let's look at the progression of Daniel's posture through this chapter. He started out on the ground. He was raised to a position on his hands and knees. He was then raised to his feet. Now he's back on the ground again. Let's look at the verses that show that. Daniel 10:9. I heard the words he said, and when I heard them, I fell into a deep sleep, with my face to the ground. Daniel 10:10, the next verse. Suddenly a hand touched me and raised me to my hands and knees. I'm assuming that's Gabriel, the man in white linen with a gold sash. So now in verse 10, Daniel is raised to his hands and knees. In verse 11, he said to me, Gabriel said to Daniel, stand on your feet. So now he's back on his feet. And now here in verse 15, while he, that's Gabriel, was saying these words to me, Daniel, I turned my face toward the ground and was speechless. In verse 17, the verse says that Daniel had no strength. Well, here's some possible reasons why. The majesty of the angel. Daniel perhaps felt unworthy to converse with so exalted a creature. It could be the nature and importance of the things the angel said. In other words, the majesty of what was being reported by the angel might have made Daniel fall down speechless with no strength. Remember, all of this is about Israel, and Daniel is very concerned about Israel. And as verse 1 said,
the whole visions that are coming, chapters 11 and 12, are about a quote-unquote mighty conflict. That's enough to scare anybody. Another possible reason why Daniel fell with his face to the ground, speechless with no strength, is because he was conscious of his own impurity. Or it could be a combination of all three. Now this man, with a human likeness, again, who is he? Well, I say he's the man clothed with linen and with a gold sash, as we read in verse 5. And people have speculated that man could be Jesus. I've already told you three reasons why I don't think it is. Gabriel, who in my humble opinion was the man in linen with a gold sash, some people have speculated it's another of the attendants of Christ. That's just eerie speculation. So we're going to take it as Gabriel. He touched Daniel's lips in verse 16 so Daniel could speak again. And when he does speak, he says, "My Lord," speaking to Gabriel, "because of the vision, anguish overwhelms me." Guzik says that the Hebrew for anguish here, translated as anguish, means twisting or writhing pain like childbirth, or like when you have a kidney stone, which I have right now. No, I don't think the Hebrew word is quite that bad. Nothing can be that bad. But whatever it is, one can see that Daniel was quite upset and quite concerned about what this vision might mean. And he was quite upset that he was visited with such an angelic majesty as Gabriel. How can someone like me, your servant, notice the humility, speak with someone like you, my Lord? Lord is how you address a noble. And then he says, "Now I have no strength, there's no breath in me." Then the one with human likeness, i.e. Gabriel, touched me again and strengthened me. Gabriel was helping Daniel out here. We go to Daniel 10, verse 19. He, Gabriel, said, "Don't be afraid, you who are treasured by God. Peace to you, be very strong. As he spoke to me, I was strengthened and said, 'Let my Lord speak, for you have strengthened me.'" Now in verse 19 here at the beginning of the verse, Gabriel tells Daniel not to be afraid, "you who are treasured by God." Now that's the same language that Gabriel used of Daniel back in verse 11 of this chapter. He said to me, "Daniel, you are a man treasured by God. Understand the words that I'm saying to you. You are a man treasured by God." And we also saw in Daniel 9 verses 22 and 23 that a man, an angel, specifically named Gabriel, called Daniel a man treasured by God. So I'm assuming that these two human-like figures are the same as the man with the linen and the golden sash, and are both Gabriel. We go now to Daniel 10, verse 20. He, that's Gabriel, said, "Do you know why I've come to you? I must return at once to fight against the prince of Persia. And when I leave, the prince of Greece will come." The first question, "Do you know why I've come to you?" is somewhat puzzling, but Gabriel wants Daniel to remember that Daniel prayed, and that prayer was the reason that Gabriel had come to Daniel. Gabriel was the answer to the prayer. So basically he's saying, "Remember why I've come to you in answer to your prayer. So don't worry. Don't have so much anguish on your face." But then Gabriel says, "I must return at once to fight." Now, of course, we're assuming that he's fighting big demons. As I said earlier, it's difficult to know what these angelic, demonic fights really were about. But I've got some good summary statements by gotquestions.org. Summary statement number one, the battle is real. Oh yeah, you can bank on that. I believe angels are fighting demons. Statement number two, it seems that as events play out on earth, there is corresponding activity in the spiritual realm. In other words, there's an effect on human affairs that flow from angelic demonic encounters. Now, I don't believe that demons have control over human beings. I realize that that was an old superstition still held by many people, astrologers and such, and even philosophers in the Middle Ages, maybe even in the ancient Greek world. But that's not what we're talking about here. We're talking about influence, not control. No angel ever made a dictator do something evil to his country. So anyway, summary point number two by gotquestions.org. It seems that as events play out on earth, there is corresponding activity in the spiritual realm. Okay. Point number three by gotquestions.org. Whether or not this spiritual prince of Persia's fate was tied to that of the physical Persian Empire is unknown. We do know that if his job was to keep the Persian Empire in place of dominance over the nation of Israel, he failed. The reason he failed is because the Greeks came under Alexander the Great and wiped them out in 336 BC. Now, Gabriel says, I'm leaving you, Daniel, by the Tigris River here. I've got to go back and fight against the prince of Persia. And when I leave, the prince of Greece will come. That means when I leave you, Daniel, not when I leave Persia. When I leave you, Daniel, then I'm going to have to deal with the prince of Greece. Well, that's because he came later, the big demon behind Alexander the Great. And I do believe Alexander the Great was demonic. I deduced that by reading his biography. He was a sick son of a gun, arrogant, thought he was God, most probably thought he was God. As I said earlier, most of the commentators take these princes to be demons. Gill says the prince of Persia was a demonic prince. Clark says the prince of Persia was a demonic prince. Joyce Baldwin, the modern commentator on Daniel, she says it was a demonic prince. Jameson Fawcett and Brown. However, here are two well-known commentators that take the prince of Greece to be Alexander the Great himself, in the flesh, not a demon behind him. And so Gabriel is saying, when I leave you, Daniel, the prince of Greece will come. Now, of course, that would be in 336, and we're now in 537 or so, I think it was. So that's a good while later. But to me, that's a reasonable speculation that John Calvin and Adam Clark made. It could be Alexander the Great. I report. You decide. We go now to the last verse of this chapter, chapter 10, verse 21. No one has the courage to support me against them. This is Gabriel speaking, talking about his fights with the prince of Persia and with the prince of Greece. No one has the courage to support me against them except Michael, your prince. Now, when it says Michael, your prince, I wonder whether that's where the common notion that Michael is the special archangel for Israel, because he says, Michael, your prince. However, I will tell you what is recorded in the Book of Truth. Now, what is recorded in the Book of Truth is going to be laid out in chapters 11 and 12, and we'll have a good time going through that. Remember, chapter 10 is just the introduction to Daniel's last revelation. Now, what is this Book of Truth? Well, if you're like me, you tend to think, well, that must be recorded somewhere. Well, no, this is a vision that was given to Daniel for the first time. It was not recorded anywhere except in Daniel's brain. So the options for Book of Truth, physically recorded in a physical book? Option number one, I don't think so. Option number two, the phrase is symbolic for the secret book of God's decrees. Jameson Fawcett Brown, Gill, and Barnes all take that approach. Recorded in the Book of Truth. In other words, it's true. It's a symbol. Option number three, some people have said the scripture. Well, no, it can't be the scripture again because it was not recorded in the scripture anywhere. Notice what Gabriel says. I will tell you what is recorded. It's already been recorded? No. It was when Daniel wrote the book of Daniel and it became canonical, but not until then. Now let's look at some scripture which uses symbolic language of writing down something as being true. Deuteronomy 32:34. Is it not stored up with me, sealed up in my vaults, like a record sealed up in the archives? Well, God doesn't have vaults with a piece of paper in it with something written on it. Malachi 3:16. At that time, those who feared the Lord spoke to one another. The Lord took notice and listened. So a book of remembrance was written before him for those who feared Yahweh and had high regard for his name. A book of remembrance was written before Yahweh. That's obviously symbolic. Psalms 139:16. Your eyes saw me when I was formless. All my days were written in your book and planned before a single one of them began. God is a spirit. He doesn't have a book up there in heaven. This is just a way of expressing truth to us mere mortals down here. We use books, so God used the metaphor to teach us. Revelation 5:1. Then I saw in the right hand of the one seated on the throne a scroll with writing on the inside and on the back, sealed with seven seals. Now, obviously, that was a vision. That was John's famous vision of the seven seals. He was looking at that in a vision. That was not a literal scroll. So that's what Gabriel meant here, written in the Book of Truth. In other words, what I'm about to tell you, Daniel, it's going to happen. Ladies and gentlemen, we have finished Daniel 10. We are now ready to go to our next audio and cover Daniel 11, which I will call Wars Between the Seleucids and Ptolemies. Or if you prefer the anglicized pronunciation, War Between the Seleucids and the Ptolemies. I hope you stay tuned for that exciting audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.